COVID-19, among many things, has changed our cities. A lot of them are empty, shuttered, they're stilled. Places to pass through rather than linger or conduct commerce. Perhaps one of the more dramatic aspects of these transformations has been in the urban soundscape. It's the quiet of absence, or perhaps that the sounds of subtler presences, birdsong, wind. The sounds of the city, it's more than a matter for these sorts of casual observations. We have long been listening to our cities, and increasingly in the age of the smart city, our cities have been listening to us. Indeed, the history of listening in cities is a fascinating one, and it tells us a great deal about how we arrived where we are today. To delve into this, Shannon Matten is a columnist for Places. She's a professor of anthropology at the New School in New York City, and her most recent essay there caught our ear, Urban Auscultation, or Perceiving the Action of the Heart. Shannon, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's go to that notion of the pandemic and the city. And of course, their stillness has been an aspect of that. And suddenly, I don't know, what are we suddenly hearing in our cities?
Well, there's been a lot of attention paid to what we're not hearing, as some of which you have alluded to, less frequent traffic, a lot of stilled industry, which means less construction. Some other industrial noises have been quieted. And what that opens up is an auditory space for us to listen to things that have been all around us, but we haven't been able to pay attention to because in many cases they've been drowned out. So things like the sounds that are a part make, the sounds that our radiators and HVAC systems make, birds, other wildlife, reminding us that we actually co-inhabit, we live together in the city with other species. So these are the types of things that we've been newly able to pay attention to. And I'm not sure if this is a tradition around the world, but in New York in particular, for quite a while, we had a 7 p.m. daily tradition where everyone would lean out their windows and cheer for the first responders, the essential workers, which was a nice kind of moment of making noise together.
It was all very first wave, though, I think, along with the sourdough baking. But the thing, though, about that the auditory environment, I mean, it's been quite a compelling feature of what we have noticed in the pandemic. Why do you think that is?
In part because I think there has been an attuned attention to our multiple senses, to our bodies. We've recognized our vulnerability. And of course, this is a privileged position that one is suddenly recognizing their vulnerability. There are certain populations, various individuals who are immunocompromised who have always known this. Mm. But I say it's a much wider recognition that we are listening for signs of particular coughs. We also know that the pandemic, one of its symptoms is a thwarting or kind of an inhibiting of our smell and taste. So I think paying attention to the senses is something that the pandemic has kind of all five senses, something that the pandemic has attuned us to.
Yes, a cough can suddenly still a room. you write that we're constantly revising the way we listen to the city. Can you walk us through a brief history of that and how that's perhaps shifted, I don't know, back to the beginning of the 19th century, for example?
Sure. So in the past 20 years or so, there have been a lot of historians who have written about, who have taken up what's called sensory history. So much history has been written from the visual, from an ocular-centric point of view. There have been so many historians who have attended to how we can write history through smell or through sound or through taste or one of the other senses. In terms of specifically how the city, how we have retrained ourselves or listening to the city differently through history, that is shaped in part by the way different auditory technologies, and technology I am kind of using broadly to encompass much more than digital technologies. So the way the combustion engine, the way the siren, the way the horn, the surfaces we put on our roads and how those have transformed the movement of wheels or horse hooves or footprints on our feet on those surfaces have created a new sound bed, essentially, for urban sound. So as these new technologies have reshaped not only the physical environment itself, but also the way we listen to one another, to music, to broadcast, those have tuned our hearings in different ways. And that has been shaped not only since the early 19th century, but I think throughout human history.
That notion of the sort of the urban sound bed, and I'm trying to imagine that in a city of unsealed streets, of horses clip-clopping, of big carriage wheels rolling, of people pattering about, of the absence of so much of the mechanical noise which has become a feature of our urban environment.
Absolutely. This is something I'm going to recommend the work of historians like Emily Thompson, who has written about urban history. And it's difficult to imagine because we are trained, we are attuned with 21st century ears to extract the way that we have been conditioned to hear through the poor quality of an MP3 file, for instance, which is music for a lot of folks, or the presence or absence of certain kind of ambient technologies. The fact that, you know, the car radio is a relatively recent, within the past 100 years or so, phenomenon. So just the presence or absence of these technologies have definitely shaped, you know, the way different generations have listened to cities.
It's possibly a bit blunt, but has anyone done any work in sort of imagining just on a base sort of decibel level what that ground noise is and how that has changed over time?
Yes, there is. He calls himself an acoustic ecologist. There's a person named R. Murray Schafer. I almost blanked on his name. He wrote about the soundscape. Some folks, it's a canonical text. And he has looked across history and looked across cultures as well to see how certain sounds, including the sounds of kind of alternating current, the basic electrical hum that is specific to particular regions of the world, how those form what we could call a sound bed or a bass tone that other sounds are then layered on top of. I'm not sure that he actually goes into decibels. He's talking a bit about hertz, so the specific tones, but I'm sure we could talk about decibels as well.
You, in your writing, you dwell on this idea of cities historically being compared to organic bodies. I mean, the beautiful example of parks being the lungs of the city suddenly brings that into focus, and you give that. Can you tell us a bit about the medicalized history of listening and the way in which that has turned to listening to the city?
Sure. So, and this is also a very COVID pandemic kind of appropriate topic of discussion because it gets into different techniques of diagnosis. So throughout in different historical periods and in different cultures, we can use various imaging technologies to diagnose what might be ailing a body, but listening to the body has historically been very prevalent. And so tapping on the body, listening to the movement of fluids, even listening to the cough of COVID-19, for instance, a specific kind of signature form of cough. So these have been historically waxed and waned in popularity, particularly as we develop new techniques and technologies that allowed us to look inside the body. There was a shift in epistemology. Sight, vision, being able to look at something was a more verifiable statement of fact than listening. So you can see kind of a shift in medical training is privileging or marginalizing these particular sensory modes of diagnosis, depending upon what techniques and technologies were prevalent at a time.
So in listening to the city, how does that manifest? What tools, perhaps, or what psychological approach do we take to listening to that city as body?
Sure. So you can see there's kind of a domain shift of some of these techniques. So while we were developing new technologies to listen to bodies in the medical field, they trained us to assume that we could transfer some of those techniques over to other realms as well. So the instrumented forms of listening where we have a device that is between us and the thing that we want to listen to, whether that's a beating heart or breathing lungs, or a noisy or quiet city. So instrumenting our mode of listening. So we're just transferring something from the medical realm over to the urban realm. And this applies not just to listening, it applies to urban planning and transit. We use these metaphors from one domain and use them to kind of shape the way we think about and administer things in another domain.
There's a shift in metaphor, though, is there not, in this story of the city from body to machine?
Yes. So we have used multiple metaphors to think about cities. They have been bodies, and that has manifested in multiple ways. They have been humors, so using kind of the pre-systemic notions of how bodies work, that is. Then we think about cities and bodies in terms of circulatory, respiratory, nervous systems. Then we move on to machines, and then more recently we have thought about both cities and bodies and kind of computational metaphors.
I'm seeing the city now as an artificial intelligence, perhaps.
Yes, absolutely. And that has informed, again, both medicine and urban planning.
Okay. Well, I mean, to go into that in terms of this thing of the listening, I mean, we listen to the city listens to us. This is the sort of interesting development at the end of that sort of chain of metaphor, is this very active closing of the circle by the city itself.
Right. We could also maybe say that there are some historical precursors to the city listening to us in terms of there's been a long history of designers, architects, urban designers being aware of acoustics, whether or not they knew the physics and had the instruments to actually practice acoustics as a science is something that obviously comes later. But even as early as Vitruvius, kind of like in Roman times, people were designing reverberant spaces so that the voice of a oracular kind of society, the voice of a speaker could be heard and could reverberate through kind of across kind of reflective surfaces to amplify itself. So we have been designing cities to be sonic environments for thousands of years, but the city itself listening to us, recording us, kind of and analyzing our sounds is something that is a relatively new phenomenon made possible by artificial intelligence technologies.
Just to double back on that, I mean, I can see architecture being, you know, very absorbed in those auditory environments and the cutting edges of architecture being so much involved in buildings that form that function, churches, parliaments, those sorts of things, where the, you know, the human voice is such a key to the design of the space. How, though, does that then work out into conglomerations of those buildings, of those auditory environments? At what point do we start to see the sort of the combined auditory effect within a cityscape, within an urban field?
That's a great question, and I don't know that I have thought about that before, because there is has been some work, not only you know recent historical scholarship, but for a very long time, folks have been thinking about intentional design of spaces that are made specifically for their sonic qualities. You mentioned several musical performance spaces, the history of kind of classical music composition, where certain composers were writing pieces for performance in specific performance venues, you know, taking into consideration their particular resonant qualities. Hospitals. Well, this is maybe one case, getting to your question. Now I'm kind of talking myself into an answer here. So the concern with design of hospitals, recognizing that noise is something that exacerbates health problems. So we had rules for keeping voices low, not making a clamor in the hospital to facilitate and to expedite the healing of the sick. And we recognize that that on a grand scale was inimical to people's healing. So that's when you have things like zoning coming into being. So you would prohibit the development of the clamoring trades. You know, metalsmiths, for instance, would not be able to have a shop right outside of a hospital. So there we have something where we're thinking about the immediate sonic environment that is promoting well-being, and we extend that out into the city. And this allows certain adjacencies of activities because they would promote kind of a discordant sonic relationship, noisy sounds or noisy activity next to a space where we really need quiet for the desired activities to happen, like learning or healing or worshiping.
We might elevate a railway, for example, to, you know, to take that sound above the human ear on the ground.
Right. But that also obviously produces quite a clamor itself. I think it's probably not until we put them underground that we really achieve the desired effect there.
Let's jump forward into our modern smart city and the way in which it turns its ears on us. I mean, we're, as a society, as a community, often quite affronted by visual surveillance. We wrinkle our noses at the thought of facial recognition and cameras, but listening surveillance pretty much gets under our guard.
Right. There has been a lot of theorizing, legislation, public discourse about facial recognition technologies, in part because there are such compelling stories of when they fail. We've heard a lot about how the training data sets for facial recognition technologies are kind of inherently biased. They're trained on white normative faces, and they don't recognize faces of color, women, people with disabilities as readily, which can be both a good thing because then you kind of slip under the radar. Some people don't want to be recognized, but it also means that there are kind of some very awkward or unjust encounters that happen. So we've heard a lot about this. There's been a lot of written about it and spoken about it, not so much about similar automation technologies applied to listening. But these are happening too. I mean, these aren't just kind of speculative technologies. They actually exist in a lot of places. So we have one example that most people might be familiar with is a technology like ShotSpotter, where it's often applied or affixed to utility poles where they're kind of machine listening devices that are listening, trained specifically to listen for gunshots and to be able to try to triangulate between multiple locations to help then the police, law enforcement, discern the specific location that a gun might have been shot based on kind of an analysis of the reverberations in that space. So that's one case. We also have technologies that can listen to voices. We have aggression detection software that is increasingly being deployed in places like schools, because in the United States, unfortunately, we have had a terrible track record of mass shootings, of school shootings. So as a placating method, a lot of school districts are implementing aggression detection software that can give a forewarning of when voices are raising, and that means there's a foment rising that we might want to intervene before something violent happens. These technologies are very fallible. It's kind of, in a way, a form of security theater. But these are just a couple examples of the way spaces and cities are listening to us.
Well, indeed, and that none of that information goes to waste. I wonder what that mass data is now beginning to look like and what potential uses that might be put to.
Yes. So when we aggregate this type of data, we can use it for all types of diagnostics and recognition. One could be to identify undocumented immigrants, for instance, to test for the presence of certain kind of accents or shibboleths, which are kind of the words that really are the tells, the giveaways to determine if someone is a native speaker of a language or a non-native speaker, for instance. We could also use it for mental health or physical health diagnosis. There have been some proposals, don't want to say patents, but folks proposing technologies amidst COVID-19 to propose aggregated listening softwares that would listen for the sound of kind of the signature cough or sneeze or other type of auditory marker of the disease that could provide kind of macro scale diagnosis of who might have this particular illness in a public space.
And of course, the inclination of all this in combination is for the machines that run this within the network of the urban space begin to learn from their experience, begin to act more intuitively, begin to develop that sense of intelligence. Intelligence within a city, it's just a remarkable thing to conjure with.
It is. And it's kind of interesting that we use these different synonyms, intelligence, smart, and we want to contrast those with the form of kind of indigenous or local embodied knowledges that people living in a city have developed through trial and error, through practice, through kind of generational transmission over again centuries or millennia. And we have to contrast that with the more positivist, data-driven forms of intelligence that a smart city and these technologies tend to promote.
I'm wondering what it does to the auditory environment of a city. How is that changed by the fact that so few people in the city wandering about in it are actually listening to it? Most people are tuned into something stuck in their ears.
Well, some folks have used the whole concept of like an auditory cocoon. So we are creating our own kind of self-selected soundscape. I mean, this is exacerbated by things like Spotify. So not only do we not buy albums anymore, we don't listen to the radio, in which like there's a pre-programmed set of auditory stimuli being directed to us, there's a lot more agency we have in determining what we listen to, in what order, and through what mechanism, and in cultivating the even the environment in which we listen to them by plugging our ears directly into the sound source. So that really does not only separate us from the physical environments, which in many cases offer very helpful cues to us about important things that are going on, like traffic or the presence of threats or pleasant kind of encounters, but it also dissociates for us from kind of our immediate social environment, from one another.
Yes, I wonder if, I mean, in this long history of cities and sound, I mean, the pattern has been to attenuate those noises towards human comfort, I guess. Perhaps if we opt out of that environment, then the reverse might begin to happen.
Yeah. There have been some urban designers and large engineering firms that have actually proposed sound designing entire cities. So there are so many variables that you can alter, not only in an architectural environment, but then scaling that up to a city scale. So using particular materials for our buildings, using particular kind of paving materials, and incorporating various types of white noise machines and other types of kind of vegetation buffers, water features, etc., to really cultivate an entire kind of choreography, or to use an auditory metaphor, like a symphony of sounds that brand or cultivate a particular character for different parts of the urban environment. So that's a very hubristic kind of macro scale way of thinking about how we could actually social engineer and orchestrate an entire city sonic environment.
In a strange way, though, I'm suddenly attracted to it. I'm intrigued by that place.
There is something appealing about it, but you do kind of orchestrate out some of the more serendipitous or chance encounters, which we tend to romanticize in many cases when things are automated.
Of course, but any event, I'll be walking through it with my buds in listening to something on 11, so I just won't notice. Shannon, thank you so very much. It's a fascinating area of inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Shannon Madden, the columnist for Places, professor of anthropology at the New School in New York City. We will put a link to that essay, Urban Auscultation or Perceiving the Action of the Heart. We'll pop that up on the Blueprint page, the Radio National website. And yeah, this is Blueprint Radio National.